Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do, for they preach but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. And they love the place of honor at feasts and only the best seat in the synagogues, and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. And call no man on earth your father, for you have one father who is in heaven. Neither be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Christ. The greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted." If you listened to last week's teaching on the purpose of polemic in the Greco-Roman world, then you are already acquainted with the function of insults between differing schools of philosophical thought in the ancient world. Philosophy in those days, meaning a desire to leave behind vice and pursue virtue, to become morally healthy. I know, shocking, right? That isn't what it means today, oftentimes. The problem was that there were different schools of thought, and each thought themselves to be the one true way. In pursuit of supremacy, they practiced the art of polemic, which can be described as Hellenistic insults. Josephus described the different factions within Judaism in his day as competing philosophies. The Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes, competing for the hearts and minds of the populace. Polemic was a way of exalting oneself, one's own philosophical bent, one's school of thought as supreme, while labeling other schools as morally deviant. No one was better at this than the Essenes, who saw anyone who was not an Essene, whether Jew or Gentile, as reprobates and even cursed them as part of their daily rituals. Hi, I'm Tyler Don Rosenquist, and welcome to Character in Context, where we explore the historical context of Scripture and talk about how it bears on our own behavior and witness as image bearers. You can find my teachings on my website, theancientbridge.com, and contextforkids.com, as well as on my YouTube channels, accessible from my websites. You can also access past broadcasts on my podcast channel, characterincontext.podbean.com, and my context books for adults and families are available through amazon.com. So we have a lot of interesting little mentions in this week's section of Scripture, taken from Matthew 23. We have Moses' seat, phylacteries, and some versions say tefillin, tassels, or they might say tzitzit, rabbis, fathers, instructors, etc. So what did all this mean to Yeshua's, or you may call him Jesus's, Jewish audience? Word of warning, I might be stepping on toes this week because we have a few anachronisms that we tend to read into the text. Anachronisms are references that are out of place or out of time. For example, reading homosexuality into an 1890s era story about the gay 90s would be an anachronism. Gay men or gay didn't mean that way back then. Just like mouse wouldn't have any technological connotations in the nursery rhyme Hickory Dickory Dock. Because certain words mean certain things now, we tend to assume that they always did, and that's natural, though we don't do that with mouse. Sometimes we just need to unlearn some stuff. You know, no big deal. We aren't first century people, much less first century Jews. Modern Judaism looks little like the Judaism of Yeshua's time. Modern Judaism is largely based upon the philosophical teachings of the 12th century scholar named Maimonides. And he was a great scholar. I am not dissing Maimonides. So we're going to clean up some misunderstandings before we actually dive into what Yeshua was saying here. Okay, first of all, Moses' seat Sometimes says the chair of Moses. Excuse me. I know that there are a lot of teachings out there that definitively state that it was this or that. But the honest truth is, we just don't know exactly what it was. Yes, there was an ornate stone chair, and I quote-unquote chair, that has been found in ancient synagogues. But there's quite a bit of scholarly debate as to whether this was even a chair or not, or perhaps a bima, which is the stand on which a Torah scroll is placed for reading. There is actually no documentation anywhere describing one. And so we have a lot of opinions, and that's all we have. Some folks take these opinions that, you know, they might read an opinion in a paper or in a book and then go on and speak about them as though it was an established truth. But the truth is that we just don't know for sure. Was it this stone cherished thing, or was it figuratively speaking about the authority of the Pharisees and Sadducees in setting and enforcing their legal enactments based on Torah? That's Pharisees and scribes, not Pharisees and Sadducees. You know, the evidence is sadly inconclusive, and you know what? That's good for us. It humbles us. It also causes us to explore different things that we might not explore otherwise, which is good. Second, the heavy burdens, aka the traditions of the elders, aka the oral Torah. It wasn't in written form yet. That wouldn't happen until the compilation of the Mishnah by around 200 of the Common Era. The Mishnah can be thought of as like the legal rulings of the Supreme Court, and that's the Sanhedrin in ancient times was the Jewish Supreme Court, much like our Supreme Court. Ours just has a lot fewer people on it. And these were, the Mishnah were the final decisions of case law. It makes up half, not actually half, but it makes up one half. There are two parts of the Talmud, and this is one of the parts, let's put it that way. So the rest of the Talmud is called the Gemara, which contains all the legal debates, and as such, it is very long and arduous to go through. Also, it means that there are many opinions in the Gemara where there aren't opinions in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is actual rulings. You know, and these opinions, some of them are absolutely nutty, but they're recorded so that if a question comes up later, or came up later, it could be proved that something had already been brought up, debated, and either accepted as valid or rejected as invalid. This misunderstanding has caused a lot of problems with people who are new to Torah and don't understand how the Talmud works. Now, not to be confused with later mystical works like the Zohar. These are legal documents and legal arguments. They were not yet written down in the first century, and so we do not know which legal enactments were and were not already in place during the life of Yeshua. Because a lot of them, I mean, it comes down to cultural stuff. Well, what do we do if we're living in a city? What do we do if we're living in the country? What about this? What about this? What about this? Rulings had to be made because there were only 613 laws. And most of them had to do with the temple and the priesthood. You know, which by the time the Mishnah was, it just didn't exist anymore. And, you know, if you have a law, if you have a certain thing according to this in the Torah, well, the Torah doesn't really cover what to do in a case-by-case situation. That's the Mishnah and the Gemara. All right, we do the same thing. You know, what does it mean to get rid of leaven? What does it not mean to get rid of leaven? That is something you debate. That is something that there are rulings on, and we all have our own little ideas. All right, does that make sense? I hope so. Just nod. Okay, I'm going to assume you're all nodding. You know, even though we don't know which things were and were not in being done in the first century for sure, we can find explanations for a lot of the little things Yeshua is doing or refusing to do by studying it. And sometimes it's a little bit hypothetical, and we should say, well, this might be it, you know, instead of saying, oh yeah, this is it. Now, third, phylacteries, or they're also known as tefillin. This commandment rose up from a literal interpretation of passages like you find it in Deuteronomy. It talks about it shall be a sign unto you on your forehead and on the back of your hand, that kind of thing. They're talking about the word of God being bound to you in some way. And so there are all these different verses, and the Tefillin were developed. We don't know when exactly. There is some misunderstanding in some circles about the Tefillin worn by Jewish males and nowadays by some females. They were not to be worn all the time, but only during the hours of prayer, which is the third, sixth, and ninth hour. That is when they would do the hours of prayer at the temple. And they do them in the synagogues today, too, where they would be strapped on. It binds around the forehead, and it's a box that's on the forehead. And then, of course, there's a box on the back of the hand, and there's a strap that goes on the arm to bind that arm. They were strapped on for the recitation of the Shema and the Amidah, which are the standing prayers. Later, Talmudic prohibitions addressed making them large or decorating them lavishly or wearing them outside of the specified prayer times. So when we see Yeshua dressing this here, this would have been agreed to by later Pharisees. Or not later Pharisees, I'm sorry. Later rabbinic scholars, because the Pharisees, there are no Pharisees today. Pharisees were the modern rabbinic movement, and the people who wrote the Mishnah and the Gemara, the Talmud, they are the inheritors of the Pharisees, but they're not Pharisees. That's also modern Orthodox Jews are like Pharisees in some ways, but they've come a long way since then. But it's like your ancestors, okay? I'm Prussian by ancestry, but it doesn't mean I'm a Prussian. It doesn't mean that anything that the Prussians did had anything to do with me, especially since, you know, Prussians don't exist anymore. Maybe that was a bad example, because obviously because Pharisees don't exist anymore, so it was okay. Just let's move on. I don't know. So, yeah, Yeshua's dressing this here, and we see later in Talmudic prohibitions that, yeah, this was not acceptable to, you know, normative Jewish behavior. But there was obviously problems. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't have addressed it in the first place. So whenever I see someone posing for a pic with them on, as opposed to having their picture snapped during prayer or while donning them, I kind of think about the prohibitions on wearing them frivolously. This isn't something to do in order to look Jewish. They were worn during prayer in order to satisfy a commandment. So important. All right. Fourth, tassels or tzitzit. Despite a lot of teachings to the contrary, no one was yet wearing the talit gadol, the large four-cornered prayer shawl, in the first century. It was actually a medieval invention. Numbers 15:37 through 41 stresses the keeping of this commandment as to the wearing of the tassels on the corner of one's garment. And the invention of the talit only came about as an interpretation later of that commandment once four-cornered garments were no longer being worn. But during the first century, they still were, all right? We can see the first references to the actual talit gadol during the time period from 300 to 500 of the Common Era. In works such as Baba Batra 98a, that's in the Talmud, that's in the Gemara section of the Talmud, Genesis Rabbah 36, and Exodus Rabbah 27, at which time it was still only being worn by great men and scholars. So it took a long time before this became normative in Judaism, all right? And not in all branches of Judaism, I gotta say. So during the time of Yeshua, when men still wore four-cornered garments, the tassels would have appeared on the hem of the garment. During the Bar Kokhba revolt in the second century, we know that the combatants were wearing them. And so they wouldn't have been wearing their prayer shawls in battle, okay? Okay, in fact, in the catacombs of Marcellinus and Peter, who were two martyred 4th century Roman Christians, there is some artwork depicting Yeshua healing the woman with the issue of blood. This is a very, very famous piece of artwork. She is kneeling down and grabbing the tassels that are hanging from the hem of his garment. So obviously this was something familiar to the audience of the time, as opposed to the Talit Gadol, which is what we call the Talit today, which was only much later worn by anyone but elites, and Yeshua certainly wasn't an elite, and even if he was, back then they weren't wearing them. But you know, a lot of times what we get into trouble with is, like I said, these anachronisms. And there's a certain tendency for people in the Hebrew Roots movement and Messianic Judaism to make people in the Bible more modernly Jewish than they need to be. A lot of times you'll hear about Paul wasn't a tent maker, Paul was a tallit maker. Well, there was nothing un-Jewish about making tents. People had normal professions. I mean, just like today, people have normal professions no matter what their religion is. Every society has to have certain functions filled, and making tents was a perfectly Jewish thing to do, and would only require him to have, it wouldn't require him to have, like, huge things that he would, it was, can you imagine him hauling around a loom to make Talit Gadol? No, it just wouldn't happen. But there's been kind of a backlash because for so long, Paul was looked at and Jesus was looked at as a Christian instead of a Jew. And so, you know, the pendulum swings too far both ways. Every time it swings a little bit too far. And so as kind of a backlash because of people making Jesus and Paul into Christians who didn't obey the law, you know, it swings the other way, and oh, we want them to look like modern Orthodox Jews. And you can't do that either, because even the Pharisees didn't look exactly like modern Orthodox Jews today. So let's not try to make people artificially Jewish in modern ways. It's okay that Paul made tents. It was an honorable profession. And it's okay that, you know, they had tassels from the end of their garment. Doesn't make them less Jewish, it just makes them first century Jewish. Okay? I hope that makes sense. All right, fifth. The designation of rabbi did not mean then what it means now. Now it's an earned academic title or an actual designation of ecclesiastical authority. But in the pre-70 world, it was more of an honor for elites. It was the sort of thing that people would call respected members of the community. Notice that only outsiders and Judas after the betrayal ever called Yeshua rabbi. The disciples never called him rabbi, they called him teacher. Rabbi was a term for outsiders, people at a distance, not people who were close. This was a world of honor and shame, of definite case systems, and of course a case system is a system of it's a tiered hierarchy, with some people on the top and some people at the very bottom. We see that today in places like India, where you've got the Brahmas and the whatever at the top, and at the very bottom you've got the untouchables. And nobody, there's no upward mobility. There is downward mobility, but not upward mobility. So in the case system of the first century Jews, you got the high priest at the top, chief priests under him, Sanhedrin members and elites below that, all the way down to the Am HaAretz, were the people of the land, and then beggars down below, and prostitutes, and tax collectors, and those guys. Now, rabbi was simply another form of honoring some people above others in a time when people were acutely aware of where they stood in the social ranking. Inferiors were required to greet superiors, and in the proper way, by the proper honorifics. A higher up would not greet a lower down. It wouldn't happen. You wouldn't even, like, acknowledge them, but you expected them to acknowledge you. But Rabbi, in the way that we know it now, was still hundreds of years away and was very slowly phased in. At this point, it was simply an expression of inherent social superiority from a distance. It was outsider language. Okay, sixth, the designation of father as a title of respect and social superiority, often used for elders in general in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament. The Jewish writing Pirkei Avot, Wisdom of the Fathers. It's the father was like the sages. It was the very, very respected people. Seventh, the designation of instructor as a recognition of absolute authority. Mentor would be kind of a modern equivalent, but not really, because there is a assumption of superiority in all these titles. This isn't talking about, you know, not calling your dad. Don't do that. Or it's not anything wrong with saying, oh yeah, that person is an instructor over at the local college. That's not wrong either. That's not what's being talked, or that person is the rabbi over at the local whatever. That's not what's being referred to here. Okay, now that all that is out of the way, let's reread the passage, and hopefully I can get through this before the break. Then Jesus said to the crowds, and this is Matthew 23, by the way, if I have not mentioned it, and this is out of the ESV. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the scribes and Pharisees sit on Moses's seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do. For they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long, and they love the place of honor at feast and the best seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others, but you, are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. And call no man on earth your father, for you have one father who is in heaven. Neither be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Christ. The greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. And so we're seeing here the theme of this entire thing was the practice of exalting oneself and exalting others. You know, it's about social superiority. It's about caste systems. It's about who gets to sit where. Who greets who first in the marketplace. Who gets the respect and who gets to give the respect. As opposed to what Yeshua has been teaching throughout the Gospel of Mark, especially the Gospel of Mark, that they must become like little children, that everyone is a brother with one father, with one mediator between God and themselves, and one way, one truth, one life, one light of the world, one all of those sorts of things. Really, it's a big reality check. That there are no elites in the kingdom of God. That there aren't people who are born lowly and born high up. That in God's eyes, that all people are brothers and sisters. I mean, really, what he's saying right here is something that we should all keep in mind. I mean, I would say, yeah, I'm smart, but compared to God, I'm an idiot. So what does it matter that I'm smart? Because I should compare myself to God, not to anyone else. And I shouldn't compare anyone to me and then either say, oh, you know, they're better than I am because they have this quality, which is intelligence more than me, or lower than me because they have this quality less than me. I mean, if we get into that, we get into all these things where, well, are athletic people better than me? Am I inferior to them? How about people who are born wealthy? Are they better than me? Am I inferior to them? It just gets into this crazy situation, but this was the ancient world that Yeshua and all of his followers lived in. And With all that said, we will be right back. Hi, this is Tyler Don Rosenquist, and welcome back to the second half of Character in Context. Context. And this is the second part of a I don't know how many part series on the woes of Matthew 23 that were addressed specifically to the scribes and the Pharisees. A lot of times, once Yeshua gets in Jerusalem and he's telling parables, they are directly against the chief priests and the high priest. High priest. Actually, you know what? I take that back. High priest, because as we'll learn at another time, really the high priesthood, although it was to Caiaphas was sitting in the seat of high priest at that point, his father-in-law Annas, he was actually controlling the whole game, and he had been for decades, his family. So, all right, so let's talk really briefly about who were the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, I get sometimes, this is really funny, this is terrible because people are so casual about insulting each other, but sometimes if somebody doesn't like something I have to say and they say, oh, you scribes are all alike, as though somebody who is a writer is automatically a scribe. But that is actually has nothing to do with the scribe in the ancient world. Now, scribes were a professional class of literate Torah experts who would often be employed in the writing of contracts, like the ketubah, which is the marriage contract, and the get, which is the divorce contract, and all other sorts of contracts. And they would write them in accordance with not only with Torah, but in the legislations on Torah enacted by the Sanhedrin. So they would come up with ways that you had to do contracts, with ways that you had to do this, with things that had to be done. And contracts were required, and these guys were the guys that carried it out because they knew the law, they knew the interpretations of the law, and so they could do this. I couldn't do this, so not a scribe. Author, yes. Writer, yes. Scribe, no. I do not have the qualifications. Pharisees were a philosophy within Judaism. Remember, philosophy isn't what we classify philosophy of these days. And Josephus actually called the Pharisees a philosophy of Judaism. So they were a philosophy within Judaism dedicated to bringing temple levels of purity into the home. And this wasn't the only thing they were about, but this is one of the things that causes a lot of confusion, you know, especially centering around the quote-unquote dinner table as an altar. So if the home's the temple, then the altar, or the dinner table is the altar. Hence they were very concerned with the minutiae of the law, often adapting temple regulations to home use, like the father is the high priest, and you know the different people, they're priests, so they wash their hands before breaking bread, as the temple priests were required by law to wash their hands before approaching the altar of God. Now, Pharisees were divided into two schools, that of Hillel, who was more liberal, lenient, and welcoming to converts, and Shammai, who was stricter and not at all welcoming to the conversion of Gentiles. Oftentimes, the questions and tests brought before Yeshua actually boiled down to differences in philosophies between the schools. As we discussed in my broadcast on Eunuchs in the Kingdom, which is episode 7 on my podcast channel. So, but this is going to be funny. Okay, so some people will say, you Pharisee. Well, that's a silly insult. And I'll tell you why. One, we don't see it in the Bible. No one says, oh, you're a Pharisee, just because they don't like something that they're saying. You know, it'd be more accurate to say someone is acting like Pharisees, or in modern vernacular, some of you are acting like some of the bad Pharisees, and we'll be talking about the different kinds of Pharisees that the Talmud talks about, because there were supposed to be 7 kinds of Pharisees, 5 of them were unrighteous, and 2 were righteous, and it didn't have anything to do with the different schools of thought, it had to do with how they behaved. But that's kind of funny, and we will talk about that. I don't know when, because I don't know when it comes up in the lineup, but it will at some point. So, but if we call someone a Pharisee, it's like he's saying, oh, you're just a Presbyterian or Southern Baptist, you know, Hebrew roots, you know, you're just kind of calling somebody a denomination. And that's silly. Wouldn't you laugh if somebody did that in real life? Just, you know, whatever. But, you know, we take these words, sometimes we don't know what they mean, and so sometimes we try to sound exalted or holy by coming up with quote-unquote biblical insults, and we use them in unbiblical ways. And you're going to come across a lot of these things throughout the woes, like blind guides, like whitewashed tombs, things that people think they know what they mean, but they don't, and so they use them wrong. And so people who know the context, just they're covering their head, they're going, oh, geez, I can't deal with it. All right. So, well, I'm not going to go into a lot of details about the schools of Hillel and Shammai. They were both first century BCE Torah scholars, teachers, sages, whatever you want to call them, but they had schools where people learned from them. All right, so they were the two competing philosophies within the philosophy of Phariseeism. So we've got philosophies and philosophies and philosophies, and actually that's what you could call all denominations. You could call them philosophies, because really that's a better way of describing them. Okay, because we all have our different philosophy on how things are best done, right? Yes, we do. So, like I said, I'm not going to go into a lot of details on these two groups. We will do that later. But suffice it to say that they were very influential in first century Judaism and very popular among the people, but they did not hold the supremacy of later rabbis. Certainly not of somebody like Maimonides or that. Although Hillel is still very revered, don't get me wrong, and Shammai is kind of not. Now, the Talmud, as we will discuss in the following weeks, often has some very unflattering things to say about the Pharisees, like I just said. That being said, they were powerful as far as holding positions of authority in the Sanhedrin, and Sanhedrin decisions were legally binding on the Jews, as Moses declared in Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 through 12. And this will be important in the passage we're studying today. Oh, also, it's important to know that not everyone was a Pharisee. There were really only, like, I think Josephus said there were somewhere around 6,000 Pharisees. That's it. 5,000 to 6,000 Pharisees. That's not a lot of people in a country. It just really wasn't. So it's not like to say everyone was a Pharisee, or we can say every Jew was a Pharisee. Very few Jews were Pharisees, but most Jews respected the Pharisees, and they were very popular. Not like the Sadducees, who were not popular, but they had to be respected because they were the high priests and chief priests, and they had a lot of money, and they had a lot of power, and they were in bed with Rome. So, there's that. All right. The entire passage that we've been reading is about the societal notions of superiority versus inferiority among the followers of Yeshua's quote-unquote philosophy, aka we might call it messianism, when we're supposed to be brothers and sisters. But this was not their world. This was radical. We go, yeah, we know that just because someone's rich doesn't mean they're better than someone who's poor. Doesn't mean they're inherently genetically, you know, whatever, or that even genetics can determine superiority. I mean, that's ancient. You know, we're coming out of that. Still see it rear its ugly head, like with Nazism, where Jews were supposed to be the dregs of society and the disabled were the dregs of society, and anyone who was Aryan was like the epitome of God's creation. Especially if you had blonde hair and blue eyes. So we see it cropping up. We do. It's not gone. And we see it in India today. obviously, but, you know, it's less and less. We're more likely to see people as kind of born with a blank slate, and they can accomplish anything in theory. In theory. All right. What Yeshua was suggesting, like I said, is actually quite shocking, that in God's system there would be no caste system, where certain people were innately better, where it is incumbent upon the lower caste person to properly address the higher, to make sure not to sit in the spot where a higher ranking person should be. And we see this in the epistles, where there were evidently problems with the rich being given favored seats in the congregations, in the synagogues, and to frankly bow and scrape before one's betters. So is Yeshua saying that some people don't have authority? No, because the scriptures are very plain. The high priest had authority. He did. Even Caiaphas, it said Caiaphas was prophesying because he was high priest that year. So obviously there was authority. The priests had certain authority. The kings had certain authority. Did it mean they were better than everyone else? That's not what authority is about. Authority is about having authority. Boy, that was a brilliant... so much for the inherent superiority of me. I couldn't come up with a better explanation than that. But authority isn't necessarily about superiority. Authority is just a measure of influence, and sometimes biblical influence. You know, those kings, some of David's ancestors were toads. They were gooberheads. They were just reprobates. They were still the king. All right? So it didn't mean they didn't have authority. Of course they had authority. They had divinely ordained authority because God gave the throne to David and his descendants through Solomon forever. But, and the high priests, sons of Aaron, they had authority. It didn't mean they were good people. It didn't mean that they were of superior birth. It meant that they were of a specific bloodline that was supposed to be kept pure, and they had certain obligations. But, you know, for the kings and for the high priests, with those obligations came some serious restrictions on their lives. High priest, priests in general, couldn't marry anyone they wanted to. High priest was even more restricted on who they could marry. So they couldn't just go to another tribe and say, oh yeah, there's a beautiful woman, I want her as a wife. Well, she's not a daughter of Aaron. Tough. You can't have her. Because you're a priest. Because you're a high priest. Because you're in line to be high priest. You can't go to your best friend's funeral. You can't even go to their house. You can't do anything. You've got to remain clean. It was not, you know, with authority comes some restrictions that I certainly wouldn't want to live with. Okay. So Yeshua wasn't saying that people don't have authority. When he tells them to do what the Pharisees and scribes have a right to do when they are legal arbiters in court cases, he's clearly upholding the Mosaic law. Now, they can be rank hypocrites in their personal lives is totally beside the point. Just as we in our modern world need to obey the laws of the land regardless of how our politicians behave, as long as the laws aren't inherently immoral. And Paul also expresses this. But we don't think our politicians are superior beings. Do we bow and scrape and defer to them? You see, we no longer think as ancient people did, because in the ancient world, the answers to the questions, are politicians superior and do we bow and scrape and defer to them, would be, well, yeah, duh. But we no longer think this way. I was reading a parable this morning from Seder Eliyahu Rabbah 2, and I'm going to read from on page 226 of Parables of the Sages, Jewish Wisdom from Jesus to Rav Ashi by Notley and Safray, which I have mentioned before. Very good book. And this is insanely offensive, and it goes entirely against our modern sensibility. So just grab onto your chair. Get ready for your mouth, for your jaw to drop, because it is offensive. All right. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. This is from Psalm 29:4. A parable is told to what may the matter be compared to a mortal king who had grown sons. Some were masters of the Torah. Others were masters of the Mishnah, while others became adept at the art of negotiation. Once again, the king married a poor woman and had children by her. He sent them to study Torah, Mishnah, and proper conduct, Derech Eretz. He sat, waited, and said, "How long will it be until they are like my grown sons?" After a while, he went to be with them. They were not occupied in the Torah, nor were they occupied with the Mishnah, nor did they possess proper conduct. He sat and he clapped his hands in mourning before them and lamented, "Why did I build houses for them? Why did I acquire fields for them? Why did I plant vineyards for them?" Thus resembles Israel in the world before their Father who is in heaven. When they are not occupied with the words of Torah, so it is said, "The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars." These cedars are people who have ceased from concern for the words of Torah, but are occupied with the world. They resemble nothing other than the cedar, which does not produce edible fruit. Thus, everyone who is not concerned with the words of the Torah resembles a cedar. Okay, now, there's some legitimate stuff in there, but the assumption, and this is from the commentary here, the assumption of the commentator is that the poor woman is unable to produce intelligent offspring. Isn't that horrible? That's the ancient world. I mean, it's kind of like, now we go, "Whoa, dude, you need to go to sensitivity training." But back then, this was a foregone conclusion that a poor woman was poor because she was undeserving, because her offspring were undeserving. It just... And lest you think that that did not exist in Yeshua's time, let's see. Shammai in the 1st century BCE had this saying, "Teach only a man who is intelligent, humble, and the son of a wealthy family." Ta-da! And he was 1st century BCE, and he was one of the two major schools of Phariseeism. The thought to us that a poor woman cannot produce intelligent offspring is so offensive. But that was how they thought in those days of inherited and ascribed honor. You were honorable because you came from an honorable family, and you were shameful if you came from a shameful family. You would be a Torah scholar if you came from a Torah scholar family, and you would be a dunce if you came from an illiterate family. They didn't think about kind of level playing fields. They didn't think, well, yeah, but the Torah scholar is going to raise his kids in an environment where that's going to be a lot easier. An illiterate family, that's not even going to be an option. It's going to be a handicap. It's not a mark of inherent worth. A king who has children with a poor woman and who sends them to Torah school, they're going to probably turn out to be just like the sons, the other grown sons who did the same. It's like they said in the books, like, this does not track. The parable does not fit the application. It's ridiculous. It's offensive, but that is how they thought. So now, we talked a bit in episode 2 about how Yeshua was telling his disciples to become like little children who had zero status in the ancient world apart from what was given to them by their fathers, and a pale shadow of that, you know, even, right? So what does this mean for us? You know, there's a great deal of confusion about this passage, and so people end up having sometimes wrong ideas about some titles and not about others. But the point is, what's behind the titles and what's the intent and what's the glorification going on, or is there a glorification going on? Is it wrong to address a modern-day person as a doctor? No. No, it's actually a cultural recognition of academic achievement, not of inherent superiority. Okay? It's a societal recognition and not a valuation of inherent social work. In the same way, the modern-day term rabbi is generally an academic term or a job description. If it is used in an expression of superiority, then it falls under the no-no guidelines. And there are facets of Christianity where titles are excessively demanded and abused. You know, especially we get into, like the charismatic and Pentecostal churches, and people are going around demanding to be called and calling themselves apostle, a prophetess, etc. You know, it's funny that of the fivefold ministry gifts, and this is the one I laugh at, no one uses teacher as a title. No one has ever called me Teacher Tyler, and if they did, I would probably burst into a fit of giggles because it just sounds so silly. When Paul is written about in Scripture by Peter or Luke, he is called Paul or our brother Paul. Never does he refer to himself by any title, nor do we see others doing it. Nor do we see James and Peter, pillars of the church, bearing titles or allowing people to bow and scrape before them. But as long as there is authority to be had and respect to be demanded, there will be people who assume ministry positions in order to achieve it. They want to be called apostle, father, reverend. They want people to defer to them as superiors, not as a job description on their resume, as some people just use them as. Although I've never seen anyone using apostle just as a job description. But in order to be greeted properly in the marketplace, to be deferred to as social superiors, and instead of wearing extra long tassels or broad phylacteries, they might wear shiny suits or dazzling dresses, flashing gold watches and jewelry, driving fancy cars and living in lavish houses. I once heard a prosperity teacher within the Torah movement say that driving a fancy car is a great witness to the generosity and favor of God. But when we do that, when we show off favor, so to speak, aren't we really demanding that other people see us as extra special in God's eyes, that we should be listened to more than others? And what does that say about the poor person who is poor because they give everything they have away? Like the Hasidic Tzaddik Chaya Sarah and her husband. They were poor because they gave, you know, as soon as they got money, they gave it away. So they had nothing to show for it. They lived in a shack. You know, so, you know, by this reckoning, somebody who is generous with others instead of themselves isn't showing off God's prosperity. Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. I respect academic credentials, and I absolutely listen to people within their field of expertise. And I generally defer to what experts are saying where I lack knowledge. I have to, just like I call an electrician when the job is any more complicated than switching out a light fixture. If a computer fix is more complicated than my son can handle, I take it down the street to Computer Solutions because I recognize their superior education in this matter. When my car is broken, I don't try to use my discernment to fix it. I use my discernment to find an honest mechanic because I'm utterly ignorant myself. I hear a knocking in my engine. I can't even begin to imagine what the problem is. But, you know, they hear the sound and they can rule out a bunch of things right away because they went to trouble to become an expert. I respect people with expertise, same with doctors and nurses and my CPA. But unlike in the ancient world, I don't see them as better than me. Nor do I see myself as better than they are because of my educational qualifications. I'm not inherently worthy or unworthy because of my birth, my parents' wealth or lack thereof, or my education, or my calling to the ministry, and especially not because of my salvation status. This is where our society fundamentally differs from the ancient mindset, and this is very new historically. We are no longer under the massive delusion that people are forever bound by the conditions of their birth. You know, that being said, there are always going to be people who long to see themselves and to be recognized by others as being more than others. And that is what Yeshua is talking about here. We have one Father, and we are all brothers and sisters, and we ought not to think of ourselves more highly than we should, and those who exalt themselves will be humbled. That's it for this week, and we'll see you next week for another installment of The Woes.